Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
And once you look at it from that point of view, all the work around branding changes, because now you realize you have to know what people are thinking. The customer actually does count. It's not you just broadcasting your idea and picking up as many customers as you can. You actually have to get inside their heads and help them become who they want to be.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to this special episode of the Minter Dialogue podcast. My name is Minter Dial, and I'm your host for this podcast, a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. For more information or to check out other shows on the network, please go and visit their site, evergreenpodcasts.com. So, before I get back into the swing of my brand new episodes for 2024, I wanted to revisit a few important episodes, including this wonderful conversation with Martin Neumeyer, where so many people are needing a sense of belonging and to find meaningfulness. Working for a meaningful brand is one way to find fulfillment. Marty is a world-recognized expert on branding, a best-selling author of books such as The Brand Gap, The Brand Flip, and Meta Skills. At the time of recording this interview, back in 2019, he had recently published a business thriller called Scramble: How Agile Strategy Can Build Epic Brands in Record Time. Marty's also director and CEO of the Liquid Branding Agency. In this conversation with Marty, we talked about the importance of having a designer mindset in business and the challenge of building a superior brand in today's tech-infused world. You'll find all the show notes on MinterDial.com. And please consider to drop in your rating and review. And don't forget to subscribe to catch all the future episodes. Now for the show.
Marty Neumeyer, it's great to have you back on the show. So we are doing this, you are in California, I'm in London, and wanted to have you back on the show to make for a better ringing into 2019. So Marty, for those of you who don't know you, I consider you a guru, an expert on branding and also on design. You're the author of many best-selling books, including Brand Gap, and you've also wrote a book called The Designful Company, and your last book, which was the subject of our last podcast, was Scramble, this sort of business thriller that you put out. So great to have you back on the show, and remind us who you are, Marty.
Thanks, Minter. It is great to be back with you. I work for a company called Liquid Agency in Silicon Valley, but most of my work is theorizing, writing books, leading workshops for clients, just getting out there and spreading the gospel of brand.
So how would you describe, if you were, you know, with the beginning of 2019, how would you describe the world of branding and how it's different today than it was in the past?
Well, I would say over the last 15 years, what we're seeing is a deepening of the understanding that we had during that time when we redefined the meaning of a brand. Because, you know, brand used to be, it used to be a logo, right? A brand, you know, Can you make the brand bigger? Was something I heard a lot. I love the package design. Can you make the brand bigger?
Right.
Eventually, I started saying, no, I can't. that's a different project, but I can make the logo bigger. So brand is not a logo. These are the kinds of things we had to explain 15 years ago. Brand is not a logo. It's not a product. It's not a company. It's not a strategy. It's not the sum of all impressions. It's not a promise. Those things are all involved. But a brand is something that customers create in their minds about you. So you can say it's kind of your reputation. And once you look at it from that point of view, all the work around branding changes, because now you realize you have to know what people are thinking. The customer actually does count. It's not you just broadcasting your idea and picking up as many customers as you can. You actually have to get inside their heads and help them become who they want to be through your product or service or company. So that was, you know, my first book, The Brand Gap, redefined branding that way. But what's happened in the meantime is social media got in the act and really made that true. So now customers have way more control. And when they decide what a brand is, they tell everybody. They all have a, you know, are developed, co-developing a brand about you, your company. So that makes it even more critical that you get this right. And it often requires that you change everything about how you build a brand.
So when you go into your customers and or make speeches, do you find that this is still, there's resistance to this thought still in America, in the companies? You, I mean, because you're obviously at sort of the heart of so much change out in San Francisco area. Is it still something that people don't get? And if so, then how do you make them understand it better?
I think they get it a lot better than they did, because in the beginning, I would get a lot of pushback saying, no, 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 that's not what a brand is. You know, it's all about logos and ad campaigns and that. You know, I got a lot of pushback from advertising agencies because they could see if this were true, then their business is no longer valid. You know, so got pushback from them. I got pushback from the people that hire advertising agencies, usually marketing directors, who didn't want to see that. Didn't want that to be true, but now it's pretty much everybody just sort of like their eyes are open and they're absorbing the information. They're trying to understand what to do about it. But I don't have the problem of convincing them that a brand is not a logo anymore. That work is done. So I'm happy for that.
So if we now we understand that brand is so much more, and of course this is where you and I, you know, we're meeting of the minds and 100% enjoy that perspective, the challenge then for brand marketers today is what? What? How do you describe it? If we now get it, how do you do it?
Well, it's a big challenge. The challenge is how do you get a complex organization to execute a simple idea? You know, because, you know, organizations are full of people. So that's a problem right there. You've got people with different opinions, different levels of skills, personal agendas, all kinds of things are going on. So how do you manage to find the one idea that's going to separate you from the competition and compel the right customers to join your brand? And so what happens is because there's a lot of people and the company's complex with a lot of different goals, the simplicity gets lost. Right, it just sort of dissipates, and then you end up kind of falling to the average, and pretty much you start to look like your competition in the, from the view of customers. In the companies, from the company's view, often they see themselves as very different because they're up close, they're in it, they're inside it, so they can see the differences. But from the outside, you know, customers have difficulty seeing a difference unless it's very, very obvious. So that's what you have to do, is find that obvious, compelling idea and execute that relentlessly and then evolve it over time, because strategies decay. You have to keep refreshing them.
To what extent would you say that the agencies have been part of the problem then? I mean, you mentioned a little while earlier that they rejected these kind of notions before. Do you feel that they're now in a better position? And if so, how are they in a better position?
Yes, I do. I always knew they would figure it out because they're smart people. They're in a better position because they now realize it's not just about TV ads anymore. And in fact, all the media choices that they have are pretty fragmented. So they have to figure out how to be valuable in some other way than just charging for, you know, media that doesn't actually deliver very much, because it is pretty measurable when you do it that way. So, you know, smart companies are figuring out that it's not about marketing, it's about mattering. You know, it's like, how do you make the company matter to its customers? And the skills inside an advertising agency are formidable. You know, you got people that can really get to the crux of something and talk about it and get the word out. So the problem is how to charge for that, because it's not so simple anymore. It just used to be, you know, 15% of the media costs, which had its own problems, obviously, because the fox is in the hen house. When you say to an advertising agency, you figure out where we need to be, you know, and so, well, you have to be everywhere, you know. It's going to cost $5 million a month. So that's all changed. It's made it more difficult, but it's pretty exciting now when you see some of the things advertising agencies are doing. They're working in areas that you wouldn't have conceived of before. They're coming up with all kinds of events and things that were difficult to charge money for, right? So you put on a huge event or a stunt or something that gets a whole tribe of people involved. Well, so then you got to go to the client and say, well, it's going to cost you, you know, this is a $5 million project. And they're going to go, well, what's the return on that? And you're going to have to say, well, we don't know. You know, we can't actually measure it.
Which is always true in the past as well. I mean, we can measure, but we just don't know, as they say, which is the effective part. So you've got this idea of making things simple, and maybe in today's world, the complexity has gotten as over-complexified. And let's say there's always been complex, but now to make simplicity within this fast-changing, with so many choices mode, how does one go about getting down to that core message? What is, I mean, is this I gotta call Marty all the time? But, or, you know, that you're you know, one of the best agencies, how do you structure that notion of simplicity?
Yeah, you don't have to call me, but you have to have a sense of what's necessary, and you probably should be working with somebody on the outside who brings objectivity to it and who's worked with a lot of different companies and industry types, a lot of different personalities, who can objectively come in and make sure that you're being honest, right, and bold, right? Because that's what happens, is a lot of companies, when they do it themselves, they pull back from what they really need to do, which is have a simple, bold concept. So it does help to get the right team in to help you do it. But the work it starts from the very top of the company. You have to know, you know, what's the purpose of the company beyond making money? It's a crucial question. And it's a question that companies dodged for many years. And that's sort of how we got into the position we're in, where no one trusts companies anymore. You have to have a reason for being that's beyond just making your shareholders happy. You know, increasing shareholder returns is not a purpose, right? It's a function of being a company, but it's not the end all of being a company. There has to be something more. So if you have to figure out what that is. And then at the same time, you have to look at your core customer. Who's the core customer? If I were to describe that man or woman or child, who would that be? And what is that person about? What are they trying to get done in their lives? And then make sure that identity, the customer identity, matches perfectly with the company purpose. So those two things are at the very top. Without that, you can't get very far. However, having that doesn't do the complete job, because you still have to compete, and there may be other companies with the same purpose and the same target audience. So you have to differentiate yourself. So that's the next level down, is you have to understand what that customer's aims are. What are their goals in their life that you can solve, that you can help them with? And then, why are you the only solution for that person with that need, right? So I call that onlyness. And onlyness is, you know, our company is the only blank that blanks, the only, you know, airline that
delivers on time.
Yeah, right. That is not always on time, right? Or, you know, whatever it is. The only shoe company whose shoes are light as a sheet of paper, something like that. I actually have somebody, I know somebody who does something like that. So those are very simple, powerful ideas that you can own for quite a long time. And even if you have competitors, you can still own the idea of it if you're the first and you do it the best. So you got to start there. And then you have to get into issues of our customers probably belong to some sort of tribe. It's not even, doesn't have a name, but it's a bunch of people who think the same way. And that's a loyalty reinforcer. So if you've got, you have to know what tribe they're in, and preferably you have one tribe per brand. You don't have like a brand doesn't serve three or four different groups of people who have differing interests. That's actually a misuse of a brand. And so you have to have a very good idea of who they are. And then that tribe, the rules of that tribe have to connect squarely with the values of the company. So those are sort of three levels, two columns. And when you've got that, you've got the basis of a brand. You've got a filter for all the decisions you're going to make going forward. And everyone in the company knows what they're about. That helps you keep on target. And if you start coloring outside the lines, it'll be obvious to people who say, hey, wait a minute, if we do that, that means we're not this company anymore. So are we going to change who we are, or are we going to eliminate that path? So that's how you start.
So, you know, I think back to your book, Scramble, with that CEO, David Stone, and the way he had the turbulent path he got to finding his mission for the company that he was working on. To what extent do you believe that the C-suite, the executives, the leaders anyway, somehow, who are finding this purpose for their company, actually need to have a personal ambition to that? In other words, that it resonates actually with their deepest personal selves?
It doesn't have to. And certainly there are companies who are you know, into leader number four or five or six, so the founder's long gone. Obviously, they're not going to have that same founder's vision and passion, but they could still have enough passion and the right kind of passion to lead a different sort of company than a startup. So I would say that it's important for startups to have a founder who's the figurehead, the vision master for the brand, and believes in the brand passionately and will put a lot of effort and resources behind it. But after that, the next CEO and the next one need to really understand the company and understand how branding works in general, and know how to get the company from wherever it is to the next stage, you know, to design a path essentially from where they are to where the leader thinks they should be next.
So something that you and I spoke about briefly before we got into our chat here was content marketing. So it's sort of high on the list of many blog posts, and everyone's talking about it as a way to drive your brand. So, Marty, are you a believer in content marketing? If so, if not, explain why.
I'm suspicious of content marketing. I'm old enough to remember what happened to advertising way back in the 50s and 60s when with long copy ads and so forth that were in articles that were placed to promote a product and a product or a service or a business. And I kind of feel that they're suspect because they're sneaky in a sense. If a reader or a viewer is not sure where this is coming from and takes it as a dispassionate, objective, you know, article, but it's actually got an agenda, that's cheating a bit. And what's going to happen is that'll come back to undermine the authenticity of a brand. So I think, I mean, it can be done well. It has to be open. You know, you have to say, look, this is from the company. This is our point of view. You can't just say some bloke, you know, believes that, you know, Ryanair is the best airline in the world, you know, and tries to convince you of that, or starts telling stories that get to that, you know, get people to that frame of mind. You know, when you tell creative people in advertising agencies, design firms, PR firms, you tell them that branding is about storytelling, which it is. It's, you know, brand is like a never-ending story, like a never-ending television series. It just keeps on going, right? And and stories are part of it. They get very excited when you make that pitch to them, because they love making up stories. I mean, that's their underlying skill, is making a case, often a charming case for something that convinces people that they should sign up with a brand. The thing is that audiences actually resent that. They reject it. And they love stories too, but they want to tell the stories. You know, and that's what's happening on social media. Everyone's telling a story or part of a story about your brand, which is out of your control, right? They want to do it, and it's their view of your brand, which is what I've always said. That's what a brand is. It's a person's gut feeling about a product. So if you're the one telling the stories, there's going to be a clash at some point where they read something and they say, no, that's not what that brand is about. And they start to disassociate from it. So it can really backfire. And and I know we all want to write stories. We want to talk about the brand. That's traditional advertising's role. But we're beyond that now. So I think it's a throwback to something that was kind of discredited way back in the 50s and 60s. But, you know, most people doing it weren't around then. So they didn't see how that became regarded over time. So I think companies that want to be authentic should be very careful about how they use that.
Hey friends, this is Jim Knight, former 21-year Hard Rock executive turned best-selling author and top 10 keynote speaker.
And I'm Brant Menswar, former frontman of Hollywood's most dangerous band turned top 10 motivational speaker and best-selling author.
We host the how-to podcast Thoughts That Rock, where we talk to rock stars, athletes, CEOs, astronauts, and even next-door neighbors who share their expertise and opinions. Together, we tackle the most interesting and challenging topics of today.
Whether you want to learn how to become more confident, how to deal with anxiety at work,
or how to write a hit song, or use Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in life,
we've got hundreds of episodes to help amp up your life and move you forward.
Subscribe to Thoughts That Rock wherever you listen to podcasts, and check out evergreenpodcast.com for more information.
And clearly, at some point in that basket, you're throwing advertorials as well.
Right. That's the word that we used in the 50s and 60s, advertorials. And after a while, they had to be labeled as such. If they were going to run in a magazine or a newspaper, they had to say that at the top. And but often they would still try to cheat a bit by adopting the trade dress of the magazine or the newspaper, so it looked just like an article. And the more, you know, sort of high-end magazines and newspapers wouldn't allow that, right? You couldn't mimic the look of the real editorial.
At some level, a lot of things that we're talking about are about not cheating and not having deceit, because the issue is we kind of go down every rabbit hole we can as marketers to try to do everything we can to scream the loudest, get the most attention, and that quickly runs out of suitability in the eyes or the ears of the consumer.
Yeah, they're smart, right? At least if the good tribes, the people that, you know, the customers you really want, the ones with the money and the ones who are really capable of spreading the word about you, they're the first ones to sniff out something that's not right, and you start hearing about that. So, if you know, social media is a great way to listen to customers. It's not a very good marketing medium, in my view, but it's a great listening medium to find out how people regard your brand. It's all about what they think, and once you know what they think, you can make adjustments.
Well, and to your point, Marty, at some level, if it's not a marketing medium, it actually could be the modern marketing medium if listening is really integral to this whole notion of your brand is what other people feel about you, not what you say it is.
Well, it's an input medium rather than an output medium, I would say. Because if you start to use Facebook or LinkedIn or something to promote a message or a company, I think that's a misuse of it, because it's social media. It's not commercial media, right? So, you know, just be honest about what's an advertisement and what's not, and I think you're going to get a lot more success. The other thing is that brands more and more are built on the actual experience, the experience and the meaning of what that experience brings, which has to do a lot with the product or the service itself. So a lot more effort has to go into just making that product or service be great, right? And different and compelling. And then everything else is more about just revealing it to people and not persuading them that it's something that it's really not.
You mentioned before, Marty, events. Do you have an input as to what constitutes the right type of event for a certain type of brand? How does one go about making an event which is not just the 18th thousands sponsoring of Deep Purple or something? You know,
yeah, yeah. Well, the whole thing with, you know, so we're getting into the area of touch points. So once you have your filter for your brand, you know what the basic story is, you know, this sort of things I talked about, purpose and onlyness and so forth. You take that and you create touch points for customers, and these are the ways that customers experience your brand. So they experience the products, messaging, whatever you give them. So in my view, the touch points that you create need to be pretty original or at least fresh to really make a difference. You can't just observe somebody else doing something and think, well, that worked, we can do that, we'll just take that, our competitor did it, we should do that too. Okay, so example of that is, you know, Apple created a sensation with their Apple stores, which nobody saw coming, you know, these beautiful stores that look like museums, and it was really successful. So what happened in a few years? Microsoft put out their own stores.
And did Google looked, too.
And they look the same, right? They have that same aesthetic. That doesn't work, right? It works for the first one, so do something different. So that whole idea of creating touch points that are not only different but align perfectly with what the brand is and who the customers are, that's the art. And if you're just looking around and borrowing things from your competitors, you are never going to get there. You're just not going to have that that talked about, you know, experience that you want. You can, however, borrow it from a different industry, you know, and change it. That could be exciting. Or you could come up with a touch point that no one's ever seen before, right? That just is heretical when you first think of it, and then you realize, no, this is actually outstanding, and it aligns perfectly with who we are. So let's do that.
Something else that intrigues me about you, Marty, is your background in design. It's a word, you know, intellectually I understand, and I talk to friends who are designers, but you come at it from a practitioner standpoint, and obviously it was present heavily in Scramble, where you do about design thinking. I'd be interested to hear how you think, what is the importance, where does design fit in at an executive level, and what are C-suite typically missing when it comes to design?
Well, I think, you know, design kind of brings up ideas of designers working at a table or with a computer, you know, in a room somewhere in the basement, working on a specific thing, you know, designing a logo or a website, or, you know, or in a, you know, industrial building, designing a product. And those are all true and very important activities. But I like to look at design in a broader way. And I think of design as changing an existing situation to an improved one, which of course all those activities do. You know, let's create a better product, let's create a better logo, let's, you know. But I think of it as a way to get from point A to point B. So you imagine what could be that isn't today, and you figure out how to get there, and design is the process you use to get there. So that means imagining things that weren't there before, ideas that weren't on the table, shaping them, testing them, you know, prototyping and testing, and bringing them to a point where they work really well, and then getting, you know, putting them into the marketplace. So that's, when you think about design like that, design can be used at any level of the company. It can be used in your personal life. It can be used with a problem you have with your husband or wife. You know, you can use design thinking. So this is a really powerful way of thinking that designers kind of understand intuitively, because that's how they do their work. They do it with their hands, and they come up with new ideas and test them out and try them out and perfect them. So that's something that's very useful at the top of a company, especially in strategy, decision making, organizational design. All those kinds of things are a kind of design. You know, if you're a CEO and your company is in a position that you don't like, that's difficult, and you want to get it into a better position, take it someplace, you have to design a path from A to B. And so that's the same kind of thinking. But what happens instead often is traditionally trained CEOs will say, okay, what are other people doing? Or what did I learn at Harvard? Yeah, or Cambridge. What did we do in my last company that really worked? Let's just do that. And so all these ideas are sort of existing ideas that they pull off of a shelf and try to adapt to their situation. And often those aren't very original ideas, and they're probably not as appropriate to the actual situation. But using design and design thinking, you can get there much quicker and in a safer way and a much bolder way. So, you know, if a CEO, let's say he gets together with his team and they come up with some ideas, and some of them are pretty bold and really might work, he starts thinking about it, or she starts thinking about it, and says, wow, that's pretty risky. You know, I mean, if we fail there, that's going to be really bad. We'll lose a lot of money. We'll get a lot of bad press. We'll be a laughingstock. We'll probably go down the tube. So let's not do that bold idea. Let's just pull back and just like take a smaller step. Let's do what that guy over there is doing. You know, that's working. We'll just do that. That'll sell really well. The shareholders will love that.
Yeah, tried and true. It's a big name consultancy. How can they go wrong?
Yeah, that's right. Our biggest competitor is really doing well with that. So let's do the same thing. That's never going to create innovation. So you need a path to innovation, and if you want to innovate, you got to design. There's just no other way around it. So that's what CEOs need to understand. And then when they understand it, they see that, well, we're not really set up to support this kind of activity. I mean, we don't have the right people. The structure of the company is wrong. We don't invest properly. All these things start to be obvious. And I think that's good. I think we need to really rethink how a corporation works in an era where it's nonstop innovation, you know, as a path to success.
Listening to you, Marty, it feels like the key word is creativity, because if we're not doing what the others have done, then there's sort of a notion of origination, that I'm going to create my design path that's going to make the original output, that's going to make me bold and make me different from the others.
That's right, and it is creativity. And wouldn't you rather work for that company where creativity is demanded on every level in some way, and constant change is it's the norm in the company, where people don't say, oh no, we're changing again. Like last year we were doing that, and this year we're doing this. Geez, when's it ever going to stop? Well, if you're doing it right, it should never stop, and it should be a joyful exercise for everybody to always be contributing, always inventing as you go. So creativity is huge, but I would argue that the number one thing to create, goal of creation, is to create a customer and keep that customer. And when you think about it that way, that tallies perfectly with the definition that I use for branding, which is a brand is a person's gut feeling about a product, service, or company. Well, we need to create that customer through that brand, right? And when I first realized that that's what we should be doing, is creating customers more than creating products and services, I thought, I was very proud of that, sort of like that I stumbled into this insight. And then I was looking through some old notes from my first book, and so this goes back a long time ago, 15 years. And I found a little card I had written where I read something Peter Drucker had written. Peter Drucker, the guy who sort of invented management consulting back in the 50s, who was way ahead of his time. And he said, the only valid reason for a business is to create a customer. So exact same words back in, I don't know, 1960 or something. So nothing's new, I guess. But I think we've never really, you know, taken them up on that. And so now we are.
It at some level, it just resonates, of course, on another side, because now everyone's saying being customer-centric. And at some level, the idea there is a little bit diluted from your thought, which is, well, we have a customer. How do we now, you know, focus our energies on him or her? You're saying actually create one, which is, let's say, more up the funnel.
Yeah, it's like that's the way you build a company now, is you start with a core customer and you build it out from there. So who is that customer? Why do we want that customer? What does that customer need from us? What does that customer want to do in his or her life? If you can solve that one person's problems or challenges, then that person probably has, you know, it represents many other people that you could have as your customer, and that person will start telling other people, and you'll build it out from there. So that's, you start with just solving one person's problem, and you grow it from there. That's a much better way to do it, and it gives you the chance to learn as you go. And now contrast that with the way it's traditionally been done, which is you look at a market, someone analyzes the market, and they say it's a $50 billion market. And let's segment it into these different areas, and let's see which segment that we could win in by owning that segment. And so you sort of put people through a funnel, and they come out the bottom, and those are your customers. But what if there is no market for what you're doing? Because things are changing pretty quickly, and often the biggest companies start when there's no market at all. They build the market from scratch. They see a need and turn it into a market. So they bring the market along with it. That's how you really become successful today. So to do that, you really have to be customer-centric. You have to realize that you don't exist without that customer. So it's not you're going to exist without customers and they'll find you. No, you need to solve a real problem in people's lives, help them achieve their destiny, in a sense, in some little way, and they return that as loyalty. So it's a much different way to do business, but I think it's the way that works. When you look at all the companies that are hugely successful today, Apple and Amazon and a lot of others, you'll see how much they care about customers.
No doubt. So, Marty, I know that you are coming to Blighty, to London, in March.
I am, yes.
You tell us about what you're doing coming to your Brandmaster workshop.
Yeah, this is so exciting. I've been giving workshops on branding for, you know, 15 years, but this is the first time I've sort of compressed it into a two-day experience where at the end you learn so much that I'm willing to confer a certificate of to call you certified brand specialist. So that's the goal of this, is to get people through this material in a really fun experiential way, and so when they come out the other end of this, they have a really clear view of the playing field of branding. And even if they've been in branding for 10 years, I think they'll still learn quite a bit. They'll come out, if they pass a test that shows that they've absorbed the material, they'll come out and they'll get this, and that will be a differentiator in the marketplace for them, because, you know, it means something. So by virtue of my books and so forth, so they say, oh yeah, you studied with Marty Neumeier in this, so you understand the brand gap and all, and how to zag. Yes, I do. So it'll show people where they fit in the big scheme of things. That's the goal of this first level. And the program is actually a five-tier course. It's a five-tier program. It's five courses, kind of like working your way up to a black belt. And this is the first one. So I'm really excited that the first one is in London, because I love London. But it's the company that I started to do this is called Level C. We conceive it as a sort of pop-up brand school. So these courses will pop up wherever we get partners to put them on. So the first one's in London. Second one will be in France. Third one, I believe Chile. We're talking about maybe Ireland. So that's getting pretty far in the future. But it'll move around the world, which is really fun. So people in different parts of the world will get a chance to take these classes. And as we go and add tiers to, you know, the five tiers, we're going to roll them out about two per year. You'll be able to take more than one together. If you've got a lot of stamina, you can do a 1 2-day course followed by another 2-day course and so forth and earn a certificate for each one. But our goal is to make these certificates valuable so that an employer or a boss sees that you have it, they look it up and they go, oh yeah, this is something that you got this, and it makes you more valuable either as an employee or a consultant.
So this would be something for everyone who's basically interested in marketing, probably more at the lower level, junior levels at some level, because level one's more the introductory white belt, if you call it.
Yeah, and, that's right. And it is, but it's necessary to get to the other ones, because I guarantee that people who have been doing this for even 10 or 20 years don't know some of these things. And so it's a reset for them, because branding has changed quite a bit. And
so how much does it cost, and when is it happening?
How much does it cost?
And how do you sign up?
I don't know how much it costs. It's sort of in line with other conferences and so forth. You sign up at, I think, clearleft.com. So
well,
Clearleft
I'll be putting in the show notes. So
Yeah. Or you can just go to martyneumeyer.com, my website, and I'll have information about all the upcoming classes as they are announced.
That's great. And so the ones in London, do you have the dates? They're at the Barbizon, right?
It's at the Barbican.
Barbican,
yeah. It's your city, right?
Yes, it is. Barbizon is another city in France.
Oh, okay. Right. You and I are Francophiles.
Indeed we are.
We live in France part of the year.
That's right.
So at the Barbican in London, March 14th and 15th. So it's a Thursday and a Friday. It'll be a very active 2 days, and you'll get to meet a lot of people that are keen on branding, a lot of people who have been following my work over the years and are really eager to take their knowledge to the next level. And I suppose, you know, in time we'll be back with more courses in London, but I think it's going to move around, and I think that'll be the fun of it. I like to travel, and I think a lot of the people who take my courses travel anyway, and they're always looking for an excuse to go someplace interesting.
Sounds like a great idea, Marty. So listen, how can someone other than your website, which you just mentioned, follow you? I suppose you, or you're Marty Neumeyer on Twitter, right?
I am. Yeah, Marty Neumeyer on Twitter, one word. And you can link in with me, so same thing.
Sounds good. Marty, thanks for coming on the show again. Great to have you. Hopefully I'll have plenty of chances to catch up with you in a pub while you're doing your Brand Master workshop.
Well, that's great. Yes. Looking forward to it, Minter. Thanks so much.
So a really heartfelt thanks for listening to this episode of the Minter Dialogue podcast. If you like the show, please remember to subscribe on your favorite podcast service. As ever, ratings and reviews are the real currency of podcasts. And if you're really inspired, I'm accepting donations on patreon.com/MinterDial. You'll find the show notes with over 2,100 blog posts on MinterDial.com on topics ranging from leadership to branding, tech, and marketing tips. Check out my documentary film and books, including the last one, the second edition of Heartificial Empathy, Putting Heart into Business and Artificial Intelligence, that came out in April 2023. And to finish, here's a song I wrote with Stephanie Singer, A Convinced Man.
I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger to feel free. Trust is the reason, still I won't tell the lie. I sit here passively, hopeful you respect, anticipating the thrill of your intellect. Maybe I tell myself there's no use in me lying. I'm a convinced man, no.
suffered a convinced man in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, challenge my fate. I'm a convinced man, competition's innate. A convinced man in the arms of a woman. Revenges and struggle with deceit. Live for the challenge so life's not incomplete. What's wrong with challenge? I know soon we all die. I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger to feel free. Trust in my reason and let me show you why. I'm a convinced man, practicing my lines. I'm a convinced man, here in these confines. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, put me to the test. I'm a convinced man,
I'm ready, fire and arrest.
I'm a convinced man, in the arms of a woman.
Imagine how fast we could solve the world's biggest problems if more SaaS startups would gain traction sooner. Welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. This podcast is dedicated to sharing experiences from B2B SaaS CEOs who are going above and beyond to deliver change that is noticed. You will hear their secrets and learn what is required to build a SaaS business that the world starts talking about and keeps talking about, and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so.